Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Jason Kelly. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Bloomberg Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show weekdays at 2 p.m. Eastern, only on Bloomberg Radio.
Be a lady tonight.
All right, well, still may remain to be seen who's really going to get lucky on this deal. Caesars, they haven't had a lot of luck since that big buyout.
Did you just talk over the chairman of the board? You just did.
I did.
Okay.
A little bit.
Go ahead.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I just wanted to get to this exciting story.
I know.
I apologize.
Anyway, go ahead.
All right. On behalf, are you demanding that on behalf of New Jersey?
Yes.
Anyway, Caesars, they got bought by Eldorado. We've got the story and we've got some analysis. Chris Palmieri, our Los Angeles bureau chief, he joins us from that fine bureau on the West Coast. And Tara LaChapelle, deals columnist, well, she's in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. Chris, I want to start with you. Give us a synthesis of the news here.
Well, this is the minnow that ate the whale. I mean, Eldorado 5 years ago had two, three properties, basically a Reno casino operator, which has always, played second fiddle historically to Las Vegas. Now they're the largest owner of casinos in the U.S., 60 properties, flagship ones, including, Caesars Palace, the Flamingo, Paris, and Las Vegas. So it's a big deal for the casino industry.
All right, so let's talk about this. Eldorado shares, they're taking a hit, 12.5%. How is it, Tara LaChapelle, that we actually saw the minnow eat the whale, if you will, and roll in, Carl Icahn in all of this?
Yeah, so it's another Carl Icahn playbook where if you looked at Caesars shares earlier this year, they were trading below $8. Carl Icahn comes in, builds a big stake, starts pushing for, the usual, thinks the company should sell itself, can get more money in a deal. He gets three board seats at Caesars and helps install a new CEO who happened to be the CEO of Tropicana, another casino business that Icahn sold to Eldorado last year. Mm. And lo and behold, today we have a deal between Eldorado and Caesars. Yes. So, and the deal's at about $12.75 a share if you use the price before today. So a significant premium. It also seems to be a lot higher than the price that Eldorado was expected to pay. And remember, Caesars is still very much a very debt-laden company.
Right.
They came out of bankruptcy a couple years ago from that infamous 2008 buyout. And, it's a very risky deal for Eldorado, and I think shareholders are surprised that they're paying as much as they are for such a big company.
$20 billion of debt in terms of Caesars on the balance sheet, right?
Yes.
Roughly? Yeah.
Well, and Chris, so much of that debt goes back to 2008. We've talked a lot about the private equity deals like Hilton that ended up actually doing pretty well from that boom. Caesars not on that list in any way, shape, or form. The buyers, TPG and Apollo, they've gotten out of this to this point. But remind us why this was such a deal gone bad.
A really high price at the top of the market is the short answer. Yeah. But, you know, they started actually, they negotiated first in 2006. It took a while to close. Obviously, the world changed 2007, 2008. You know, the expectation was that the casinos were just cash machines, and competition heated up, consumers cut back. And because they had a lot of debt, they weren't able to refresh their properties to the extent. So when you know, what happens to the casino industry is, you know, it starts out in the small towns, then it gets closer and closer to the big population centers as states get more comfortable with betting. And so the newer properties it cannibalize the older ones.
I mean, is there – this is kind of – so does, I guess, Icon cash out now? Is he done? Do we know?
It's not clear what he's doing with his shares that he'll get in this deal.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Tara, you come on in on that,
well,
too.
Yeah. Icon put out a statement today, and it's actually kind of funny. He's, you know, commending the board, and he says, I rarely do this, compliment the board for their good work. But really, he had three of those board seats. So right. I think everyone kind of knew where this was heading.
You know who was super smart? I was. So, Chris, I mean, also interesting backstory here is that the Fertittas were also around this as recently as last year, right?
You may be mixing your Fertittas a little. There's the UFC Fertittas.
Oh, this. Oh, I'm sorry. This is Tillman
Fertitta. They're actually cousins.
This is Landry's Tillman Fertitta. I apologize.
Right, exactly. They all actually date to a sort of a shady casino in Galveston, Texas.
Oh, there you go. See, thanks for bailing me out there, Chris. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you don't want to piss off the Las Vegas the Fertittas.
Any of the Fertittas.
Martial artists. So you know, he had tried to do, and you know, this is kind of a little trend we have where people kind of try to swallow up larger companies to run them. You saw that with MGA trying to take over Mattel in that. Unfortunately, it's not been working for these entrepreneurs, but it, you know, he wouldn't have been a bad operator. The properties that Tillman has, the Landry Seafood and Golden Nugget casinos, are very comparable to Caesars.
But does that mean potentially, since Golden Nugget was initially interested, Tara, what are you hearing on the M&A front? Is there anybody else who might come in and do a challenge here?
I don't know. I mean, I think at this price, the market really isn't expecting another buyer. Yeah. I think this was a lot higher than most expected to see. And El Dorado is estimating about $500 million in synergies, which is pretty high. So I think some analysts are a little bit skeptical of that. And already Moody's put out a statement saying, you know, this is going to be a really leveraged company. So I'd be surprised if anyone comes on the top here.
Yeah. Like, here, have it. Well, or have at it.
And Chris, per the hangover, we should remind our listeners that this wasn't the original Caesar's Palace. Caesar did not actually live there.
No. Oh, no. Yeah. Really?
Yeah. It's actually, this is a little trivia, it's actually not Caesar's apostrophe S. It's Caesar's in the sense of all man is a Caesar.
Plural. Like a plural kind of thing?
See, mm-hmm. So full of good information. All right. Chris Palmieri, LA Bureau Chief, all things entertainment, gaming, etc. He joined us from our LA Bureau. And Tara LaChapelle, deals columnist for Bloomberg Opinion. She was here with us in New York.
El Dorado down 12.4%. Caesars right now up 14.5%. We're living large. So we definitely do want to talk about large caps in particular, because they're definitely outperforming small caps this year. Our next guest has some thoughts on that. Norm Conley is CEO and Chief Investment Officer at JAG Capital Management, roughly $1.3 billion in assets under manager, based in St. Louis, in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio in New York. We want to jump into names, but I do have one broad question to ask you, Norm, is that when you look at the large cap space, the S&P 500, we're looking at a, you know, PE of like 19.3, that's pretty pricey. And I know that's the overall market, but doesn't that say to you that we got to pull back a little bit?
Well, I think when you look at valuations, you do have to look at them in context. So the way we look at them, first of all, is in context to what are other assets trading at. So I'm going to oversimplify, if you just forgive me. I can go out today and I can buy, I could buy a 10-year treasury at roughly 50 times earnings. Or I can buy the S&P on a trailing basis between 18 and 19 times earnings, or on a going forward basis between 16 and 17 times earnings, paying about just under a 2% dividend yield. So when I look at things in that context, again, assuming, and it's a big assumption, that interest rates are going to stay relatively benign for some period of time, I don't think valuations are especially demanding on stocks right here.
Okay. Good.
All right. So let's dig into some sectors and some names here. Chip stocks, they're always top of mind for us. What do you like there in terms of specific names? Because I feel like it's not a bucket that you can broadly invest in right now.
Yeah. I mean, it's chip stocks are uber cyclical. So In the old days, we used to call Copper Dr. Copper because it had a PhD on the economy. And I think, you know,
right,
the last
it
several
told us
years,
a lot. Yeah.
It told us a lot, right. And in the last few years, I think the term or the phrase Dr. Chip has come into popularity. So, yeah, I mean, it's a super cyclical sector with a lot of cross currents. I think generally there are some really compelling valuations. So getting back to the valuation question, no matter where you come down on valuations for the broader market, there are some, we think, some compelling valuations in chips. And of course, that also depends on where you think you are in the cycle, because
right.
it is a cyclical sector.
But it's specific. You like AMAT, you like Marvel Technologies, you like Qualcomm.
That's right. We do. Yeah, we think all of those, you know, talking about AMAT in particular, we think it's got a really wide moat in terms of technology. We do think, particularly relative to chip equipment, that we're either at or near the trough for the cycle that that company is related to. And if we're right, we think the next year to 2 years for that company should be pretty good.
Talk to me about Ulta Beauty. I mean, it's down today pretty markedly, 3.5%, owing to the Amazon effect. These are two names that
right.
you like independent of each
right.
other. How much do you worry about Amazon when it comes to Ulta?
I've made the mistake in the past 6 or 7 years of worrying too much about Ulta being overly affected by Amazon.
Huh.
In other words, I've owned it at least two other times in the last 6 or 7 years and incorrectly sold it because of that fear.
This stock is, we marvel that it is often
right.
among the biggest gainers or losers in any
right.
given day. It moves around a lot.
It does. Today's news, which you know, is that Amazon, you guys have covered it. Amazon is getting into the professional beauty supply business. I really don't think it should be affecting Ulta the way it is. So I do think that the perceived negativity is probably a bit overblown.
I mean, I will say, as somebody who buys a lot of stuff, you know, there's something about going into Sephora or an Ulta and you get to play around with stuff. And I think that's going to be a hard model to overcome. But I will
right.
say, if you're buying it the second time around and Amazon can do it and get it to you tomorrow and maybe
right.
even at a better price, that's
right.
where I think they can
threat.
Really, you know, pull
right.
out a market.
Talk to us about Salesforce, because that's a name we've talked a lot
mm-hmm.
about. There's a big story in Bloomberg Business Week a couple weeks ago about Benioff and sort of trusting his gut, obviously doing some big deals, the Tableau
right.
Acquisition. Why do you like Salesforce here?
Well, we think, you know, we like the deal with Tableau. So mm-hmm. we think that solidifies their position in enterprise software. And really, as Salesforce has grown over the last few years, they strategically have had to make a decision. And it really comes down to, do they want to continue to get closer and closer to competing with Microsoft, who's
right.
the big gorilla in enterprise? And we think this shows that they do. And they probably had to do a deal of that sort. So we like it. We like the company and what they're doing. We think they have a great position in enterprise software.
Hey, Norm, just got about 30 seconds here. PayPal's another one. It's up like 38% this year.
Right.
I feel like despite all the threats in the financial sector and other payment services coming in, they really still kind of hold their own.
Right. Well, with one 22-year-old and two teenagers who say, Venmo me, please Venmo me as a verb, and all of our friends with similar situations, not to over Peter Lynch it, but we really like PayPal and what they're doing in digital payments.
To just see it being used, right?
Right.
There you go. All right. Norm Conley, Chief Executive Officer and Chief Investment Officer for JAG Capital Management, about $1.3 billion in assets. He's based out in St. Louis. He's a Cardinals fan and a Domer, a proud Notre Dame grad, joining us here in New York.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed.
Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch Stratacoaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow, did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann, let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
If your career is a buccaneer, it's the life of a pirate for me.
So we are going to talk a little bit about trade pirates in particular. The headline on our story is the U.S. was a trade pirate. And of course, it was written by our Bloomberg New Economy editorial director. He is in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio. I always love your perspective.
His name is Andy Brown.
Did I not say it?
No.
Oh, Andy Brown. I do this to everybody. You're part of the family. Sorry, Andy.
It's actually a true sign of affection because she only doesn't introduce the people that she knows and loves. At least that's what I keep telling
myself.
Because
it's just like, let's go. I'm blushing. They can't tell this on radio. Andy, it's good to have you here.
Thanks. Great to be here.
And I have to say, when Jason and I talk about this, we read your stories and we're like, oh, man, I hadn't thought about that. And everybody should think about this. Tell us what you wrote about.
Yeah. So I just think it's worth reminding ourselves that China is not a uniquely bad trade actor. And anybody who's been to the Boots cotton mill in Lowell, Massachusetts, knows that the entire industrial revolution in the United States, which began in the textile industry, came from mechanized spinning and weaving looms that were stolen from Britain.
So the U.S. was a pirate too?
The U.S. was a pirate too, and not just that. I mean, these days there's all kinds of talk about what Mike Pence calls the whole of government, Chinese government threat to the United States, and much is made of Chinese talent programs as an underhand way of China getting hold of U.S. industrial and military secrets. But guess what? The United States had exactly the same programs in place 200 years ago. It pioneered these and lured over British scientists and engineers with financial and other incentives to come with their families and help the Industrial Revolution. So, you know, having said that, however, you know, that method of development just won't work anymore. Mm-hmm. And China keeps falling back on this and keeps saying, well, you know, we're a developing nation, give us a break type thing. And, you know, unfortunately, China is too big. It's too influential, it's too powerful, it's too ambitious to industrialize and to behave in a way that every single emerging economy has since the United States. Japan did it, Taiwan did it, South Korea did it, Singapore did the same thing. I'm afraid it stops with China. It is too big, and its policies have now distorted the global trading system to such an extent that they threaten to blow the whole thing up.
All right, so we are, with that backdrop, that very optimistic backdrop, we are headed, you know, within days of a meeting between these two heads of these superpowers, President Trump and President Xi. Given that background, what are you expecting? What is this going to look like when these guys get together at a very eventful G20?
You know, the gulf between these two sides is so enormous, and a single meeting, albeit a summit meeting between Xi and Trump, is not going to fix the problem. I mean, fundamentally, the United States exaggerates the threat from China along the lines that I've just described. It's not a uniquely bad actor. And it does this to justify a set of economic sanctions that go well beyond any reasonable punishment for Chinese trade infractions. It starts to look like this isn't about trade. This is about a Cold War and taking down the Chinese economy. For its part, there is very little soul searching in China about the root causes of this trade conflict. I mean, China just doesn't seem to have understood that this isn't just about Trump. It isn't just about trade surpluses. This is about its industrial structure and the whole world, Japan, the EU, you know, Korea, all of these countries have exactly the same problems with China.
You know, it's interesting. There's a line that I wrote down from your story. Fitting a rising China into the global trading order is a central challenge of our era. And right, where do we place China, right? How do we treat it? How do we deal with it going forward?
Well, that's just it, because it's unique. Nothing like China has ever happened to the global economy before. So, yeah, I mean, it's true that China does have tens of millions of people living in poverty and tens of millions of more who could be tipped back mm-hmm. into poverty tomorrow. You know, they're one illness away, one industrial accident away, one flood away from going back to poverty. You know, per capita income in China is about one-sixth of what it is in the United States. On the other hand, China has cities like Shanghai, 20 million people, you know, who have living standards that approximate those in a southern European country.
Creation of billionaires, isn't it the highest?
Billionaires, minting billionaires faster than any other country on earth, controls whole industries, sets an economic, a global economic agenda through Belt and Road Initiative. So it can't, you know, it has to start taking more responsibility for its actions rather than posing as this defender of free trade while doing very little to adjust the fundamentals, you know, of its own skewed economy.
Well, you know, and one of the other things you point out in your piece this week is about talent. And we talked a little bit with Anurag Rana, all of our colleague on the BI side, who's done a study of this. Help us understand the talent piece of this, because I feel like for many people, especially those of our listeners who are working in tech companies and other types of companies, these H-1B visas, I mean, this is a critical part of the talent pool. And this is getting caught in the trade crossfire.
This is where Trump's trade policies are going to be so disruptive and destructive to the U.S. economy. I mean, whatever damage China is doing to the U.S. economy through its trade policies, I think is going to be exceeded by the damage that the U.S. will be doing to its own economy if it pursues this kind of policy. America needs talent. Silicon Valley is built, obviously, on talent that comes in from places like China and India. So it's losing now. Its greater scrutiny of H-1B visas means that students are much more reluctant to come to the United States. And by the way, the education industry in the United States is a huge money earner. I mean, tens of billions of dollars a year.
We just did a show at the Harvard Business School, and this was one of the things that they talked about, that this pushback against Chinese immigrants and so on, like what it means for entrepreneurship and ultimately growth in our economy here in the United States keep pushing back.
And we talked about the Red Scare when it comes to medical research, cancer research specifically.
So what do we do, Andy? So you understand, okay, so I think you set the stage really well. So what's the approach that needs to be done with China? If they're not coming up and being kind of accountable for who they are today, how do we get them to that point?
Well, clearly not through tariffs, even though most of the world believes, as the United States does, that China is gaming the system.
Right.
Tariffs are not the way. I mean, people keep talking about this, and it's no less true for the repetition, is that you need a coalition if you want to really fix the problems in China, or at least try to address them in a meaningful way. And that's the opposite approach to the one that the Trump administration has taken.
Right. I don't know.
I love this guy.
I know. But you've also said that you don't ultimately expect something to come out of G20, right?
You know, this is the other thing we haven't talked about is Huawei. And Huawei is the big sticking point. I mean, the question here is, can Xi really negotiate with a gun against his head? And that's the way he looks at this threat by Trump to kill Huawei. On the other hand, Trump has dug himself into a big hole here, declared, you know, Huawei to be a national security threat.
Right.
You know, how does he then go back and say, actually, we got that wrong. It's fine. We can do business
with
these guys.
Either of them to like back off.
And it goes to this broader thing we've talked to you a lot about, Andy, which is this decoupling of the U.S. and Chinese economies. Andy Brown.
See, I didn't have to introduce him because we all know
we just learned something.
It's the guy we learned something from.
The editorial director of Bloomberg New Economy. Always good to have Andy Brown.
Great to be
with us.
Thank you. You've been struck by a smooth criminal.
All right, well, this is a must-read in, really an issue of must-reads. It's the heist issue, and this is the first taste we're getting of it. It's on the terminal today. The polygamists accused of scamming the U.S. out of $500 million. If that doesn't get you in...
Wait, what?
I'm not sure what will, exactly. David Voriakos, U.S. legal reporter. He co-wrote this story. Joel Weber is also here. He is the editor of Bloomberg Businessweek, of course. So, David, give us the movie pitch for this, because this feels like a movie. What's the essence of this story?
This is a story about a couple of brothers in Utah who are polygamists, and they have several wives and many children. And the Internal Revenue Service and the Justice Department accused them of defrauding the U.S. government out of more than $500 million. And their partner in this was an Armenian immigrant in Los Angeles who's been accused of crimes for many years. And the government says that they laundered $134 million to Turkey.
So, Joel, I got to take a step back because I'm thinking the reporters come to you and they're like, oh, so we have this idea. It's these two brothers in Utah and they're polygamists. And you're like, done.
Yeah.
Sold.
right, look at the words here, right, in the headline. Polygamy, scam, $500 million. Like, yeah, you got me. And to be clear, you know, accused is also in there. Yes. Innocent until proven guilty.
To be fair.
But, you know, this is a news hook. This case is actually going to come to court in July in Salt Lake City. And it's one that I think it has all this drama to it. But it also has this great business side because this group is an offshoot of the Mormons.
Mm-hmm.
And they are known as the Order. And according to our reporting, thanks to David Ford, you know, there's elements of organized crime that the government believes that this organization has. They also have amazing sophistication. The guy that David was referring to actually has a PhD, one of the brothers does. And so the scam that they're accused of is a biodiesel credit scam. So this is not like your entry level, like kind of like, you know, some kind of betting thing in New Jersey. It's like these guys actually orchestrated something that seems to be sort of incredible. And David, can you give us a sense of how the mechanics of that transaction seem to have worked?
Right. So about a decade ago, Congress passed a law to encourage the production of biofuels using ethanol or animal fat or used cooking grease. And the law requires refiners to mix that into their transportation fuel, and that would increase the reliance on renewable fuels. And
right, and that was an era when oil was going sky high, and we were concerned about the viability and resources. This was really before fracking, right? So this was an important government move.
Right, and it's a standard that's still in place, and the production standards are there for refiners and for big oil companies. And the producers, like Washakie Renewable Energy, which is what we wrote about, that company in Utah is owned by Jacob and Isaiah Kingston. And they were eligible for $1 a gallon tax credit from the Internal Revenue Service. And essentially what the government has accused them of doing is not producing the type of biodiesel fuel that they say they're producing and engaging in a conspiracy with a bunch of other fuel producers around the country in which they created phony records to say that the fuel was at a certain standard that it wasn't actually at. And so it involved a very complicated sequence of events where they moved loads of fuel that weren't what they actually said they were.
Including to foreign destinations,
right,
even, right?
Including offshore. And
getting wealthy in the process.
And the order encourages and pretty much demands that its members share its wealth with the order and not get wealthy personally. But in this case, Jacob Kingston got tremendously wealthy and lived in a large mansion and drove fast cars. And
at which point you build a wall immediately,
right.
Which is in the story as well.
No cars behind here.
And Lev Derman in Los Angeles drove a $1.7 million Bugatti.
Which That's when, you know, attention lands on you.
Right.
It's like, wait, where did that Bugatti come from? And
right.
And he was actually investigated, right, David? But they actually folded that case.
Right. They had seized the Bugatti, and Derman's lawyer, Mark Deragos, who's a big celebrity lawyer, managed to get his assets back, including the Bugatti. There's quite a bit in the criminal case about how the money moved to Turkey, and that Jacob Kingston and Lev Derman invested in businesses in Turkey with money that the government says was laundered from their fuel business.
Right. And underneath all of this, there are some phenomenal details that we can't get into right now, but it's a must read for sure. It's on the Bloomberg.
You have to go to the Bloomberg, right, or go to Bloomberg.com or buy the
or
magazine.
Or pick up the magazine later this week. David Goriakos, cool. He wrote the story with Jesse Hyde. It is really a work of art in many ways. Joel Weber, the editor of Bloomberg Business Week, he'll be back with us throughout the week talking about the heist issue. It's a tradition now, right?
Are we making it one?
Yeah.
Like, once you have stories like this, it's like, how can we not do that?
Exactly.
I just can't wait till it comes out on Amazon or Netflix, because this story is unbelievable.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
Just drive, say you crazy.
Just drive, baby.
Crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
Take a break, we can reach our destination.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
It is time for the Drive to the Close. Darley Dakey is with us. He's Chief Executive Officer at Newmarket Wealth Management, joining us on the phone from Costa Mesa, California. Hey, nice to have you here with Jason and myself. So what's going on in Costa Mesa? I'm curious what you guys, when you get together, have a meeting at your offices, what are the kind of top stories, top macro ideas that you're talking about?
Well, for us, the questions that we're getting from our investors and clients is, my goodness, how long can this market last? That seems to be the sentiment from most people we talk to, if for no other reason than this has been going on for an awfully long time. So that kind of dovetails into our thinking, which is we feel it's a good time to be diversified, not to try to time the market to get out of it, but there are a lot of other ways to make money other than concentrating on the handful of securities that have made the most money in the last 5 years. So we're talking mostly about diversification.
And so as you look at the market so far this year, you know, what do you look at as kind of the bright spots from a sector perspective? And what are the spots where you think, I'm not so sure that we're going to get in there for the balance of the year?
Well, you know, it's really this year, of course, the markets have done well broadly.
Yeah.
And that's a better sign for investors. You know, when you look in the last 5 years, and most of our clients certainly are longer-term investors and clients and thinking about their families, because we work exclusively with families, and what's going to happen with their family going forward. When you look at that data, six stocks have annualized at 27%, and a balanced portfolio is annualized at 4%. And so that's not really good for most investors to have had success by concentrating. And so what we're trying to do is look beyond that again. And there are lots of other places, you know, non-correlated assets like BDCs or REITs or MLPs or things that produce income that are not just stock-oriented are good places for people to look to get diversification and make money.
Right. So Daryl, talk to us about some of those alternatives, because I feel like that's been a bit of a holy grail. And we've seen, you know, depending on how wealthy you are, like you have better access, candidly, to some of those alternatives. Are those coming a little bit, dare I say, sort of down market or more mass market in your estimation?
Some are, and some are probably to the benefit of the mass market. And some may be added to the mass market distribution that I would still nonetheless want to stay away from. Some of the traditional alternative strategies that one might hear about, private equity, private real estate, hedge strategies, some of those are really very difficult to implement into a liquid mass market environment. But again, that doesn't mean that investors can't find alternatives to stocks, and that's really what that may mean. And so there again, business development corporations, which are direct lending vehicles, master limited partnerships, infrastructure funds, REITs, those are all strategies that are traded daily, and one can get liquidity at small amounts of money and get some diversification. There have been attempts over the years to add hedge strategies, and they haven't worked very well in the liquid markets, nor have private equity. In fact, there's a big article today about Vanguard looking to get into it. So I think there's a push to get into it. But actually executing in those markets can be difficult because of their very nature.
Well, and talk to me a little bit more about BDCs, because that's an area where we've seen a lot of the kind of brand name private equity firms go into pretty heavily. You know, you can invest in a BDC and a lot of the brand name big bulge bracket private equity firms at this point. Do you like those at this point?
Well, we like some of them. You know, like anything, there's good cholesterol and bad cholesterol. And in BDCs, it's pretty much the same thing. There are some very good business development corporations. And one of the main reasons we like them is it's a debt instrument that is often senior on the balance sheet for most corporations. So there's a little more security to them. Now, there frequently is leverage. And again, the better BDC companies have less leverage. But at the same time, you know, with a little bit of, let's say added on risk, you're also getting paid for it. You get 600 to 700 basis points of yield above the 10-year treasury. We like that. We think it's a worthy risk to be diversified amongst quality BDCs, again, even for smaller investors.
So I got to ask you, just going back to, I know what you said about like the FANG names, Daryl, but I'm just curious. I mean, Facebook's up almost 50% this year, Apple 26%, Netflix up 38%, Microsoft up 36%, Google just about 8%. I mean, I feel like we've been having these conversations for several years, consecutive years of, okay, it's time to, you know, bail out of these names. It's not good to be so exposed to just a handful of names that are moving the overall market. And yet, they are your outperformers consistently.
Well, they sure are, and those numbers you mentioned are pretty doggone good, and you know, I'd like to have some of that. But here again, I think it requires a little common sense, and don't take the bait, in other words. How many years ago, I've been doing this for 34 years, how many years in the last 34 years have I identified really great companies where the CEOs of those companies have been on the cover of every magazine? Most recently, I think of General Electric as dominating the investment world, the largest market cap company in the world. And now, it's a very different conversation. The companies you mentioned are very, very good companies. And you should have them in your portfolio. I agree. We have them in our portfolios. But the question is that what you want to dominate your portfolio?
Right.
Are you wanting to take the bet now for your portfolio? Because when you concentrate in a handful of anything, it can go badly. And it can go badly for a period of time, which would be detrimental to your ability to do what you're doing now going forward. And that's how we think about preserving wealth for our clients.
Daryl Dakey, is Chief Executive Officer of New Market Wealth Management. He joined us on the phone from Costa Mesa, California. Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com. You can also listen to our radio show every weekday at 2 p.m. Eastern, only on Bloomberg Radio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at CedarPoint.com.